everyone, and welcome to another episode of Insight. I am Ali, and we are back with our second guest spot for the sixth guest rotation while Charlie is on maternity leave. Last episode, we had Christy from Canadian True Crime, and this episode, we have an almost neighbour of Charlie's, Zach from Mystery Yes. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. It's great to be on here. It's super exciting that we finally made this happen, and totally worth the $3,000 I dropped on that ticket to Australia.
I hope you're enjoying our beautiful weather.
I don't know what the weather is, so.
Isn't that right? You went on a kangaroo before?
Yeah, oh, lots of fun. Especially jumping in the pouch. That was exciting. Yeah.
And then you got bitten by a spider and almost died, and we laughed. It's been great.
Well, I assume that was the first thing that happened. I was either going to get bit by a snake first thing off the plane or a spider. That's what we assume about Australia here.
That's how we welcome tourists.
Must be.
So as I said, your podcast is Mystery Yes.
Yeah.
Charlie and I have been big supporters of yours and Willie's since the start of your podcast. Did you want to tell the listeners about your podcast and where they can find you?
Yes, so I wrote up a little thing here because I'm not good at going off the fly. So Mysterious is basically what happens when two friends who can't take anything seriously decide to start a podcast about serious stuff. So each week we discuss a new mystery, but along the way we tend to go off the rails a bit and make some really awful, corny jokes. And it's not always coherent or respectful, but we always have a lot of fun. And, I mean, we put a disclaimer at the beginning of each episode that says if you're looking for a serious true crime podcast, save yourself some time and a one-star review on iTunes and look elsewhere. So don't say that we didn't warn you if you're expecting something different. We're pretty goofy. But, yeah, you can find us on iTunes or any podcast catcher. We're on Twitter and Instagram at Mysterious, and then on Facebook at Mysterious Podcast.
And I think the episode you did on Johnny Gosch is actually one of my favorites of any podcast. It would make top 10.
Wow.
It was really good.
Thank you.
You did a good coverage. No, you did a really good coverage.
I put way more time into that episode than I put into any other one, so I'm glad that it paid off.
So today we're talking about the case of Maitrice Richardson. When we were picking out the case for today, Zach and I both went back and forth on which case we should cover. We chose Maitrice's story because it is important to get these cases out there and give them more attention. Maitrice was a woman of colour and not your typical pretty blonde white woman. And we all know from the missing white woman syndrome, and that's where middle class pretty blonde white women, they get the majority of the attention in the media when they go missing. And Maitrice, she didn't get that. But that doesn't make her story any less important. So we want to bring attention to her case today and hopefully, look, I don't know, maybe jog someone's memory, maybe they saw something, or it encourages them to talk about Maitrice's case with someone else and then they know something. But let's get started. Maitrice Richardson was born April 30th, 1985. She grew up with her family just east of Los Angeles with her mum, Latrice Sutton, and her stepdad. Latrice and Michael Richardson, Maitrice's dad, they got divorced when she was quite young. He lived with Maitrice's grandmother not all that far away, south of Los Angeles. In 2008, Maitrice graduated with honours from Cal State Fullerton, where she studied psychology. She was also working. She had a clerical position for a shipping company. She had a second job to pay off her student loans. On Friday nights, she would work as a go-go dancer in Long Beach, California. She danced at Deborah's, which was a popular lesbian club, and she went by the name Hazel.
But our story really starts in September of 2009, when Maitrice was 24 years old. In the weeks leading up to what happened, Maitrice's behavior was becoming increasingly concerning. She had become infatuated with a woman named Vanessa, who was a regular at Deborah's. Vanessa had a girlfriend at the time, but that didn't stop Maitrice. She would follow her on trips, and it sounds like she was borderline obsessed. When Vanessa eventually told her to stop, Maitrice began to somewhat isolate herself. She stopped talking on the phone, and she posted frequent incoherent posts on MySpace at all hours of the night. She did tell one friend that she was going to receive therapy for herself, but that she was not suffering from any recurring mental illness. According to her mother, she never showed any signs of mental illness previous to this.
I don't think it was clear whether or not she actually went and got any like therapy or anything like that. I couldn't find any records that she actually did follow through with that.
And I think, just judging by what happens later, I work in mental health, and I would like to think that had she received some help, some of the stuff that we're going to see happen later would hopefully have been prevented.
Correct.
So then, in the days leading up to her disappearance, Maitrice started sending her mother, Latrice, strange, semi-decipherable text messages, which were somewhat philosophical in their tone. And all of this had Latrice really worried. And then, on Wednesday, September 16th, Maitrice sent her mother a couple more nonsensical text messages in the early hours of the morning. And then she went to work. According to a coworker at her shipping company job, Maitrice was in an unusually bubbly mood that morning. She did some work, she went out to lunch, and then she never returned. She made a late afternoon stop at her great-grandmother's house, and then left without saying what her plans were for that night. Then, later in the evening, her aunt had come home to find Maitrice's business cards from the Go-Go Club all over her porch. Also, Maitrice's aunt found a note on her husband's windshield, which was filled with a bunch of random thoughts and doodles.
Before we get further into the story, a word about our sponsor this week, ModCloth. ModCloth believes that fashion is for every body, size and shape. That's why their exclusive line of apparel is offered in a full-size range. ModCloth is the go-to source for unique women's fashion. They specialise in a broad range of styles. They have quirky statement prints, there are vibrant colours, my personal favourite, retro dresses. They have classic silhouettes and the coolest in contemporary clothing. Whatever the season you are in, ModCloth has you covered. Get that swimsuit for that summer vacation you're going on, or that cardigan for those more cooler days. ModCloth's signature line of apparel comes in a full size range, from extra extra small to 4X, so it's never been easier to find your perfect fit. Need a little outfit advice? Just reach out to their amazing team of mod stylists for free sizing, fit, and styling help. Go to modcloth.com and enter promo code SITE at checkout to get 30% off your order of $100 or more. Go get your next style obsession at ModCloth. At some stage after that, Maitrice decides to go to Joffrey's Malibu restaurant. And Joffrey's is one of those higher-end type of restaurants. And there's good reason for that. Its positioning is on the beachfront with amazing views. It's down the road from homes of celebrities like Steven Spielberg. It's the place to be seen. And it's important to note that apparently, according to her mother, Maitrice didn't know Malibu and she'd never been to Joffrey's before. It was about 45 minutes away from her house. But for whatever reason, she stops there. She booked her car, which was a 1998 Honda Civic, into valet parking, but she left her car before the valet could get to her. He then noticed her getting into his own car, and it looked like she was going through it, kind of like she was looking for something. So of course, he goes over there. It's his car, and he didn't know who she was. He later gives a description of Maitrice to the police. He describes her as having hazel eyes, having curly hair that stuck out of a Rastafarian-style hat. She had on a long-sleeve white t-shirt under a black Bob Marley t-shirt. She had on Vans with distressed jeans and a pink alligator pattern belt. When he asks her what she was doing there, she replies with it being subliminal, and she tells him that she had come there to avenge Michael Jackson's death. Maitrice then gives the valet her keys and asks him if Vanessa was there. Now, the valet said he had no idea what she was talking about. There was no Vanessa that worked there, and he didn't even know a Vanessa. When he tells her this, Maitrice tells him to keep an eye out for a girl with tattooed arms. Now, she didn't do anything threatening, and the valet believed her to be harmless. But still, he calls into the restaurant's hostess because she was acting kind of weird, and it was something that was probably worth just watching, just in case.
She asked for a table for two, even though she was not seen with anyone else at her table during her meal there. She ordered an ocean breeze to drink and a Kobe New York steak to eat. Next to her table was a party of seven, and she must have been drawn in by something that was being said, or maybe she was just feeling lonely, I don't know. But she joins them at their table and tries to join in on their conversation. But that didn't last long because she starts talking unintelligibly about astrology and astrological signs. One of the waitresses goes over and makes sure that everything's okay, because it was all a little unusual. As Ali said, this was not a swanky restaurant. The other patrons told the waitress that everything was fine. It was all a little weird, but nothing that was too uncomfortable or unmanageable. It was all weird, but nothing that was too uncomfortable or unmanageable. Mytrice then went back to her table to finish her meal. But then later, she goes back to the other table and talks with them some more. She tells them that she's about to leave for a vacation in Hawaii, and that she would contact them all when she arrived to let them know that she got there safely. The other patrons then leave. It's about 7:40 p.m. at this point when Mytrice goes to leave herself. The manager stops her and tells her that she needs to pay her bill, which had totaled $89.51, and Allie swears on her life that she will put a picture of that receipt up on the Insight Facebook page.
If someone reminds me.
Yeah, if so. It won't be me, I'll forget. Mytrice tells the manager that she thought the other table had covered her bill, but it's pretty obvious that that didn't happen. She then explained that she was, plain and simple, unable to pay the bill and that she had no money. She then proceeded to tell the manager that she was from the planet Mars and asked him if she could settle the debt with sex. After she was told that this was obviously inappropriate, she began to empty out her pockets as if to show that she had no money. And that's when a joint falls out of her pocket.
I don't know how serious she was with that joke. I guess it's open for interpretation. I think it's very likely that she may have been joking, and yes, it was a bad joke, but I really don't think she meant it in the literal sense.
No, and I've thought about that too. I don't know. It's a weird thing to say, even as a joke, I feel like. I don't know. I mean, and it's not like everything else she was saying was totally coherent and understandable either, so it's kind of hard to know.
It could go either way, really.
Yeah. And actually, I have a thought about that I'll talk about later when we talk about what we think happened.
Ah, okay. So not long after that, a 911 call was placed to the Malibu Lost Hills Sheriff's Department, and it says that Mytrice was unable to pay her bill because she had no money, and that she was acting quote-unquote crazy and possibly on drugs. Restaurant staff also report that it seemed like Mytrice would go off into somewhat of a trance on occasion. She would stare off into space like she wasn't there when they were talking to her. Before we go into what happened when the deputies did get there, a word from our other sponsor this week, ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Finding great talent can be tough. Thankfully, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job, better than anyone else. That's what makes ZipRecruiter different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't rely on job candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter find a quality job candidate in just 24 hours. There's no juggling of emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place. With ZipRecruiter easy-to-use dashboard, find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, Insight listeners can post jobs to ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/site. That's ZipRecruiter.com/site. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/site. When they were waiting for the deputies to arrive, Mytrice tells a hostess that was waiting with her that she'd been watching a soap opera when she was at work, and through that, God instructed her to just take the afternoon off. She told the hostess that she didn't have any parents, and her only relative she had was her great-grandmother Mildred. Now, she actually did have a great-grandmother named Mildred. She was 90 years old. So Mildred was contacted by the manager. She offered to pay her great-granddaughter's bill. She offered her credit card number, but apparently it was restaurant policy to have a signature for credit card payments, which honestly, we are talking about a situation out of the ordinary here, and it kind of annoys me that they could have taken the credit card information, paid the bill, and then sorted out the signature the following day. But Mildred was still talking to the manager when the deputies arrived at Joffrey's, and it was about 9 p.m. at this point. There were three deputies. There was Deputy Armando Luario, Deputy John McKay, and Deputy Frank Bowrer of the Lost Hills Sheriff Station. The manager tells of Matrice's strange behaviour. They spoke to Mildred for a short period of time before that conversation ended. After this, Mildred contacts Matrice's mother, Latrice, because she knew that Matrice was in some trouble and she was most likely going to go to jail.
McKay and Brower went through Matrice's car. In their report, they didn't mention finding her cell phone, her money, or her wallet in the car. However, I did find other contemporary news articles that report she was told to leave her cell phone and wallet in the car. What was reported by the deputies as being found, however, was Matrice's driver's license, along with some marijuana scraps and some alcohol bottles that had some booze missing. And when I say marijuana scraps, what I'm talking about was less than an ounce of marijuana. And the weed wasn't packaged up or anything, it was just lying in the center console of the car. Now, it seems that the main problem the police had was that they found the marijuana for personal use in her car. And for the record, in the state of California, which is where we are for this case, personal use of marijuana is a citable offense. However, it doesn't usually result in an arrest. But, however, Matrice was arrested and booked for not paying the bill at the restaurant, and she was also given two charges for the possession of marijuana. The employees at the restaurant did offer to pay the bill for her, and that way she could just walk away with only the pot possession charge. But then there was a concern about her driving her car when she was acting so strangely, and, you know, the empty bottles in the car suggested that she may have been drunk. So, the manager decided to press charges instead.
Matrice's car was then towed and impounded, and they arrest her and take her to jail at Lost Hills Sheriff's Station, which was 13 miles or 21 kilometres away. Now, it's important to note that at this stage, all this behaviour was extremely out of character for Matrice. She'd never been arrested before, and she'd never been in trouble with the law before. At the sheriff's office, she was given a field sobriety test, which she passes. She was not intoxicated, and this was 10 to 10 at this point, so 2.5 hours later. She admitted to having that one drink at Joffrey's, the Ocean Breeze, but she felt fine. She said that she was not under the care of a physician, and she was not taking any medication. She said that she had never been placed under a 72-hour psychological evaluation before. According to Deputy Bower's notes, Matrice seemed embarrassed more than anything about the situation, and she was coherent, polite, and very cooperative with their request. While all this was happening, Matrice's mother, Latrice, contacts the sheriff's office to find out what's going on. And something I don't know if I could do in the same situation, but in every phone call Latrice makes, and there is a few, she remains calm and polite and articulate. Despite getting nowhere, she remains calm, polite and articulate despite getting nowhere. But in this first phone call, at this point, all she wants to know is what's going on. What is the plans for Matrice? Whether she was going to be booked and released, or whether she was going to be booked and held until morning. Latrice's concern was her daughter being released onto the street with no money and no phone, because we know that she was told to leave these items in the car. And she was obviously worried about her daughter wandering the streets, not knowing where she is, because she's in an area she didn't know, and it wasn't the best area at that, so add on to that the risk of Matrice being hurt or worse. But if Matrice was going to be held overnight, then it didn't make sense to wake up her other daughter, who was 10 years old at the time, when she could sleep instead of waiting at the police station until morning.
Matrice was given the opportunity to make her one phone call, just like you see on TV shows and in movies. However, she didn't call her mother Latrice from jail, because the only number she had memorized was that of her great-grandmother Mildred, who we talked about earlier. The sheriff's station logbooks show that Matrice attempted to call Mildred 4 separate times after she was arrested. The deputies on duty claim they overheard a conversation on their end. However, Mildred insists that her phone never rang once. So I guess there's a chance that Matrice was just talking to a dead phone line with no one on the other end, and the deputies just assumed that she was talking to an actual person.
I really think that is the case in this situation.
Me too. Yeah, I mean, that's a really good explanation for it, especially if I don't know why Mildred would lie.
Exactly. Who else would she be talking to? She didn't know any other number.
Exactly. Now, what Latrice was told about Matrice being held overnight wasn't exactly right. There's only one reason to hold someone in these circumstances, and that is under Code 5150. Code 5150 basically means that a person is mentally unstable and may pose a danger to themselves or others. In this situation, the person is held overnight just to keep an eye on them and to determine whether it would be appropriate to send them for further 72-hour psychological evaluation. The deputy who was listed as the arresting officer, since he completed all the paperwork, didn't mention any unusual behavior or anything else odd in that paperwork. As we know, all Maitrice was charged with was not paying her bill and for possession of marijuana, which is not exactly the kind of behavior that would lead one to believe that a person is a danger to themselves or others. And since she had never been arrested before, it would have been a violation of policy to hold her overnight.
So just after midnight on September 17, Maitrice is released. Now she had no phone to call her parents to come and get her, she had no money for public transport, and even if she did, there are no buses that run after 9 p.m. Her mother Latrice later says that Maitrice had never taken a bus in her life and she wouldn't know the first thing about taking public transport. Jailer Sharon Cummings was the one to release her. Now she knew that her car was impounded. She knew there was no one coming to pick her up. She also knew that Maitrice had nothing on her except for her driver's license and two keys. That's all she had in her pocket. Cummings maintains to this day that Maitrice told her that she didn't need to stay in the lobby until morning because she was going to meet some friends. And then at 5:35 a.m, Latrice calls for a second time. She waited that long because she was under the impression that Maitrice was being held overnight, and she thought that Maitrice would just be sleeping off whatever was going on. She firstly speaks to Cummings, who tells her that Maitrice had been released some 5 hours earlier. Latrice is then transferred to Deputy Kenneth Baumgardner. She asks him about when she could place a missing persons report. Was it 24 or 48 hours? She didn't know. But no one knew where Maitrice went after they released her. Latrice tells the deputy that Maitrice was highly depressed and in a depressive state. At the end of this phone call, and I'll post links to these phone calls on our website, but hearing Latrice slowly break down in this phone call, it's heartbreaking. She sounds powerless and desperate for someone to help her daughter. But as I said, she remains polite and articulate. At no stage does she take out her frustration on the sheriff she's talking to.
I think Latrice's phone calls, I've heard them, and they're just really impressive, the way that she stays so calm like that. And she's the way she is in those phone calls, she's the kind of person that I feel like these officers would want to help and help solve this problem that she's having. And like you said, at no point does she even like raise her voice or anything. She's so respectful, and I just feel like she did not get the treatment from the officers that she should have gotten. It felt like they were just kind of dismissive of her.
Yeah, they're trying to blow her off. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I just, you know, especially when someone is that respectful, I think it's just really sad that, you know, that this all happened and that she got blown off like that.
And that is frustrating, because when the conversation ends, all that the deputy Baumgardner tells Latrice is that he's going to follow it up and that he'd check the lobby to make sure Maitrice wasn't sleeping there and he'd call her back in a few hours.
So while all of this is going on, at about 6:30 a.m., Maitrice is spotted. A resident of Montanito calls the sheriff's office to report a prowler at his property and to ask for someone to drive by and take a look. Maitrice is seen walking through the backyard of a residence that is placed on a large property. But at one point, the caller sees Maitrice sitting on the back stairs of that residence. Now, this property is gated with a circular driveway, and behind the property, there is a horse trail that is also used as a hiking trail. This would then give you access to the back of the property. And while there is a gate, the owners of the property leave this gate open so people riding horses and hiking can make their way along the trail. In the call to the sheriff's office, the caller reported that he yelled down to her to make sure she was okay, and Maitrice replied by saying that she was just resting or something to that effect. Now, by the time the caller was finally able to get through to the sheriff's office, Maitrice had been gone for about 5 minutes, and the caller did not see where she went. Now, I guess we don't really know beyond a reasonable doubt that this was Maitrice. However, the vague description matches, and what later happens pretty much solidifies that this was, in fact, Maitrice. So I think it's a fair assumption.
I think it was Maitrice based on the description and the location. It makes sense. It wouldn't be until 2 days later, on September 19, that the first official search for Maitrice had started. But instead of starting at the sheriff's station to see if she'd walked the 6 miles or 10 kilometres to Montenegro, or whether she'd gotten a ride from someone, which could give further clues as to what was going on that night. I mean, I think it would be telling if she'd gotten a lift, because then we'd know at some stage she was with someone, and then we would know where she was headed. But the sheriff's department get the search dogs to start looking in the last place she was seen. And again, this was only an assumption based on the loose description. This could have very easily went bad if the person the homeowner saw wasn't Matrice. But I think it was very lax of the sheriff's department not starting at where we know for a fact Matrice was last seen. That way, as I said, we could have known where she went after that to a certain extent. At the front of the property she was seen at that night, they found Matrice's shoe imprints. It looked like she'd been running. However, I mean, we're talking 2 days later here. These shoe prints could quickly get mixed up with other shoe prints and hoof prints. The searchers didn't go into Dark Canyon, which was the canyon the hiking trails run into.
Now let's fast forward to September 20th, and now we are 3 days after Matrice's disappearance, and we'll check in with a lieutenant of the Lost Hills Sheriff Station, an officer by the name of Scott Chu. Chu sends an email to his supervisor, Captain Thomas Martin, regarding his concerns about the arrest and release of Matrice. And of course, as luck would have it, this email was leaked to the media. In that email, Chu talks about the arresting officer, Luriero, and his justifications of what happened. Chu states that Matrice wasn't drunk, but she wasn't acting sane or logical either, and there was some concern about just letting her go. But somehow, in that short drive back to the sheriff's office, she was talking articulately and seemed to have gotten herself together again, so they believed there was no reason to continue to hold her. And if Allie remembers everything she's promising for this episode, she'll also share a copy of this email with the Facebook group.
I've promised a lot for this episode.
Now, despite the actual heading of this email being, "I spoke with Luriero," Chu denies writing this email or even talking with Luriero. And Luriero denies ever discussing Matrice's case with Chu. But the emails don't stop there. 5 days after this one was sent, the Lost Hills Sheriff's Department issued a statement reinforcing the reasons they arrested and then released Matrice. They pointed out the sobriety test as proof that she was coherent and wasn't confused at all.
And finally, the following month, in November, the sheriff, who was Lee Becker at the time, he wrote to his bosses at the LA County Board of Supervisors and answered claims that the situation surrounding what happened to Matrice involving her arrest and then subsequent release, he concluded that all applicable laws, policies, and procedures were followed. Because Matrice was a Los Angeles resident, her case was now passed over to the LAPD's Missing Persons Unit. 3 days into the search, on September 22nd, her case was reassigned again to the LAPD's Robbery Homicide Division. And the reasoning for this, that the officials gave the media, that it was because the division had better resources to look for her. And they pushed that statement, that this was definitely not a homicide investigation, and that they've still considered Matrice to be very much alive. The LAPD reported that there were journals written by her in her Honda Civic. They believe that she'd been sleep deprived for several days and could have been suffering from a bipolar episode the night of her arrest. And then they confirmed they found her ATM card, checkbook, and cell phone in her car.
In the meantime, the family were conducting their own investigation. They contacted sheriff personnel at every level, trying to get the jail cell video from the night of Matrice's arrest. But in the end, Captain Martin told them that the video simply didn't exist. And this was something he also repeated in interviews with the media. However, this all changed on January 6th, 2010, some 3.5 months after Matrice went missing. Latisse, Latisse's sister, and two friends all sat down with Captain Martin and Sheriff Baca at the LAPD headquarters, which are in Monterey Park. During the course of this meeting, Captain Martin admitted that, in fact, there actually was a video from the night Matrice was arrested, and it was sitting in his drawer. It would take another 3 months before Matrice's family would finally be allowed to see this video, and the sheriff's department blamed the delay on technical difficulties. Latisse later tells the media that in this video, Matrice looks scared and distressed. This video also appears to be heavily edited. An example of this is that in one instance, Matrice is holding a piece of paper in her hands, but then suddenly the piece of paper is crumpled up on the ground, making it plainly obvious that the video had been cut. But the question is, why cut something like that? Why couldn't the family see why the paper ended up crinkled up on the floor? Now, to be fair, there is a chance that the footage was edited just to condense it for an outside audience, but that still begs the question why the police would refuse to clarify why the footage was edited at all, and why they did not provide an unedited version to the family just to give them that sense of security and closure about the whole thing.
And then there was another point in the video that doesn't leave the family with any confidence in the LASD. About 2 minutes after Motrice was seen leaving the station, a deputy is seen going out an adjacent door, which could be game-changing. There is a chance this deputy could have seen nothing, but there's also a chance that he may have seen Motrice or even talked to her outside of the station. But here's the kicker. The department wouldn't reveal the name of this deputy, which does seem a bit suspicious. I mean, why not be transparent as to who the deputy was? Now, of course, as things do, the name of the deputy does come out eventually. In the first instance, he denies even being there, and then he said he couldn't remember, and then he finally said he never left the station at any time that night. What is the truth here with any of this? I don't know. There was a preliminary inquiry about this, and a 58-page confidential report was drawn up with the inquiry's findings. When you go through this report, it seems to pick and choose what it includes. The report, which was done by the Office of Independent Review, or the OIR, it talks about Motrice's behaviour at the restaurant, the interaction with the valet, the not paying for the meal, but then it leaves out the strange things Motrice was saying, like about the soap opera and God talking to her, that there was no reason to hold her longer than what they did. The report goes on to state that Deputy Baumgardner explained missing persons procedures to Latrice, but then if you go and listen to the phone call between the two of them, he doesn't do that. What he actually tells her is to just call back in a few hours, and maybe then they'll be able to do something to help her.
But that's not all this report leaves out. It fails to mention the emails we discussed earlier, and there's nothing about how the jail cell video was just sitting in Captain Martin's desk drawer for more than 3 months. And while it does mention the deputy leaving soon after Maitrice left the station, the report says that there's no way this deputy could know more than what is already known and dismisses any possibility that he could have been involved. The reason given for this claim is that when the deputy did leave the station, it was only on official business and he was with his partner. More support for this is the fact that Maitrice was seen several hours later at that house in Montenegro. But, I mean, to play devil's advocate here, this doesn't mean that the deputy didn't know where Maitrice was headed and couldn't have met up with her later on. The statement that he was with his partner only accounts for a short period of time. But after this, the case pretty much goes cold. And as with what typically happens in these cases, the media reports dry up, interest wanes, and people move on to the next missing person. And this is especially true in cases where we have, you know, the missing white woman syndrome, like we were talking about before. And there were a lot of questions surrounding Maitrice's mental health, as well as reports that maybe she had fallen into sex work and was on the streets, or worse. Regardless, there was another search conducted of the Montenegro area in January of 2010. And this was a massive search. There were at least 240 people, 60 of whom were on horseback. There were also ATVs, bikes, dogs, and helicopters. Again, the sheriff's department refused to say whether they were searching Dark Canyon. And then, a body is found within a 10-mile radius of where Maitrice was last seen.
This ended up being the remains of another missing woman from the area, but all of this was just widening the rift between Latrice and Michael, Maitrice's parents. Latrice would come out in the media and said that she accepted that her daughter was deceased, that she just wanted justice for her and to be able to bury her. But Michael, he held out hope. He grabbed onto the sex work story and would drive the streets of Las Vegas looking for his daughter. At one stage, he thought he saw her. He jumped out of the car he was in at a red light and tried to chase her, but he lost sight of her before he could reach her. He, of course, reports this to the authorities, but they just brush him off. But Michael was sure that this was Maitrice, because she'd only just returned from that Las Vegas trip. Maitrice had offers that weren't above board before, so it made sense to him that if she was struggling with her mental health and desperate for help, maybe she'd fallen in with the wrong crowd or accepted help from the wrong person. Now, was this Maitrice? Who knows? Or was this a father thinking he saw someone that he so desperately wanted to find, and it was a guilt thing that maybe he saw something that wasn't there. And then in late June of 2010, a high school friend of Matrice reported seeing her at a Las Vegas casino. This time local police took the report seriously. Now here we have two reports placing her at Las Vegas. This restarted a whole new media campaign. People took interest again, and in the days that followed, there was something like 70 more alleged sightings. But whether these sightings were real or well-intended people trying to help, nothing more came of these reports.
The case then takes another strange turn. In the summer of 2010, the searches are still going on in the Montanito area near where the horse trails are. And one day, these searchers come across a mural in an isolated drainage culvert. The mural depicts nude African-American women in various sexual positions, and some of them may look like Matrice. This led some to consider that maybe this mural was somehow related to her disappearance, or maybe it could have been done by the person responsible. But what is interesting is that while most of the women are outlined in black, some are outlined in blue. And the popular thought is that this signifies that these women are ghosts or deceased. And because this is a large mural, it would have taken quite a bit of time to paint. Along with the mural, they also found paintbrushes and paint can lids in the same location. The paint on these items had not yet dried, so it was possible that the person or people responsible for painting this mural were in the area sometime not long before the search party had arrived. Or perhaps the painters had left the mural on purpose, which makes it all the more creepy, as if this is a way for the killer or killers to taunt police, or perhaps to hint that there are more victims. It didn't take long for the authorities to have the mural painted over, as it was completed by the very next day. Some people speculated the finding of this mural was going to be the big break in the case that would lead them to Maitrice, since the women looked kind of like Maitrice, and the mural was found in the area where Maitrice was last seen.
But in the weeks that follow, they do track down the person responsible for painting the mural. Because they had previously put up graffiti in other locations, and it was all in the same style, it was possibly also may have been signed or tagged. There is a couple of issues or red flags here by the sheriff's department, though. They pick up the person, or maybe persons responsible. And I don't think they're making up finding these people, because they release a statement by the person or persons as to why they painted it. They said that they are or were a graffiti artist, and they were doing the same thing in multiple locations. And their style was similar to one of their favourite graffiti artists. And there is more to it than that, but it seemed a little much. Instead of the sheriff's department just saying, hey, look, we found the guy and he's been dealt with. The problem here is the person or persons responsible for it, they weren't charged with anything. They didn't get a fine or probation. They simply painted over the mural and said, look, we know who did it. I don't know any more details than that. It is possible there was some kind of plea deal situation where the person or persons responsible agreed to release a statement explaining why they did what they did, and then they got off with a warning. I don't know, because we don't know who did it. There was no actual names released. The problem I have with this, though, isn't necessarily them not receiving a fine. But this particular sheriff's department, they made a big deal about having zero tolerance towards illegal graffiti. Again, we don't know the details. Maybe just the fact of finding the person trumped any punishment they could give, and knowing that it wasn't linked to Matrice. Look, I don't know. It just seems strange considering the strong stance they had against that type of thing.
On August 9th, 2010, Latrice received the news that she knew was coming. But as a new parent myself, I imagine you are still never prepared for such awful information, even when it has been conclusively confirmed. So on August 9th, 2010, the Rangers were in Dark Canyon, investigating a supposed pot farm that was being run in there. Previously, there were 1,000 marijuana plants found growing, but the authorities couldn't find anyone around. They scoped out the area, but no one ever returned to it. It was the responsibility of the Rangers to head back there and make absolutely sure no one had returned and replanted the plants. But it was here that they found the remains of Maitrice Richardson. She was found less than 8 miles or 13 kilometers from the Lost Hills Sheriff Station and within 2 miles or 3 kilometers of the place where she was last seen. The Sheriff's Department were immediately called to the scene. And according to the coroner's report, an unidentified Lost Hills deputy arrived at the scene by 1:30 p.m., which was about 80 minutes after the Rangers found Mitrice. Considering the time of year it was, there still should have been a good 6 or 7 hours of daylight left, which is certainly plenty of time to get the coroner to Dark Canyon to take photos, collect evidence, and then bring the remains to the lab. And, for the record, the California State Penal Code does say that the law enforcement must contact the coroner immediately once remains are found. However, this wasn't done. The coroner reported that the sheriff's department didn't alert them until 2 minutes to 3. So that's nearly an hour and a half from when the deputy first arrived on the scene and almost 3 hours after they were initially notified that there was a body found.
But regardless, the coroner arrives at 5 p.m. at the hillside above the canyon where they were told they'd be airlifted by the LASD to the area. 20 minutes later, two detectives were flown by helicopter to Dark Canyon, but the coroner's team, they were never picked up. They wait an hour and 40 minutes in vain and decide to return in the morning. The sheriff's department later explain away the reason for this not happening as the helicopter being disposed to look for a missing hiker. But around 8 p.m, the detectives are picked up by the helicopter and returned to LASD with Matrice's remains, which is completely against official procedure. To be exact, the state code says, "A body shall not be disturbed or removed from the position or place of death without permission from the coroner or the coroner's appointed deputy." Did this happen? The most easy and obvious answer is no, it didn't. Now, we will try not to go into too much detail as to how Mitrice was found and in what condition, but there was obviously advanced decomposition due to the length of time she was out in the canyon exposed to the conditions. But the problem is with the detectives moving the body when they don't have any proper training or ability or even right really to do so. When it came to removing the body and having it lift from the ground, it was under some vines and what have you after being there 11 months, but it got caught up and the skull fell off. It was later determined that 5 of the spinal bones were never recovered from the scene that day. And because of that, there is no way that this can be correct, because if the skull was still connected until it was lifted off, there was no way that these bones could be missing.
Mitrice was found naked. Some of her hair was still attached to her skull, and there was some other hair scattered around the area. There was an earring, or something metallic like an earring, tangled in the hair that was found nearby. Also, her right leg had been removed. There were some who said that this had been caused by animals. However, there were no conclusive signs that this was the case, as there were no bite marks, and the leg was found uphill when animals tend to drag something of that size downhill.
But this was the belief of investigating officers. They explained away the nakedness of Matrice's body as animals removing her clothing. But look, come on. All that was found of Matrice's clothing was her jeans, belt which was separated from her jeans and her bra. If we're talking about animals removing her clothing, this would mean the animal or animals, they undid her belt, removed it from her jeans, they undid her jeans and pulled them off along with her underwear, they unfastened her bra and took that off of her, then they detached her leg, pulled it uphill without leaving any teeth or bite marks, then they'd have to carry the jeans or bra 500 or 600 feet down the creek and throw it into the creek, and then carry the belt another 100 or so feet downstream to hang it in the vines. And then finally, they would have had to have eaten or otherwise disposed of Matrice's 2 shirts, her underwear, socks and shoes. Really? It just doesn't seem likely to me. And then in a presser in October of 2010, the authorities changed their minds. They said that no, it wasn't animals, but rushing water in the creek that was responsible. But this makes even less sense. In that scenario, even if we're ignoring her leg being removed, but the water would have needed to rise something like 60 feet above the top of the creek bed in order to push the body in the opposite direction of the current in order to be where she was found. And since when did water have the ability to unbuckle belts, unzip jeans, and unhook bras? Look, none of this makes sense. The cause of death, according to the officials, is considered not to be a homicide and was determined to be inconclusive due to the condition of the remains. The LASD, for whatever reason, I mean, maybe there is more that we don't know and the family doesn't know, but the LASD cite the possibility of anaphylactic shock from poison oak as one potential cause, which, if you look up reliable statistics, this is beyond rare. It just doesn't happen. It has also been suggested by the LASD that maybe she wandered into the dark canyon, gotten lost, or succumbed to the elements, or maybe she was bitten by a rattlesnake or died of poisoning from that bite. But this also doesn't really make sense. Matrice was a former beauty queen. She was a bit precious. She was into looking nice and keeping up her appearance. She was a city girl. Latrice reports that Matrice was not a hiker. She would not have been wandering into the canyon by choice. I mean, there is a chance that someone saw her walking out of the police station, maybe a police officer, maybe just a person walking past. Maybe they could see she was struggling. And then someone took advantage of that. She could have possibly been raped. She was definitely killed. And then dumped into the canyon thinking that they'll never find her there. So what do you think happened here, Zach?
A lot. So, first off, I want to say that I hate, and you and Charlie have said this before too.
Yeah.
Like, I hate speculating about people's mental health. But since she was, you know, they did a sobriety test and she passed. And so to me, it does sound as if she was experiencing some sort of mental health crisis. And you know, she's about that age where a lot of those more severe mental disorders that a lot of times have symptoms of psychosis and stuff, that's when they tend to present themselves, you know, right about 24. And it really seems, you know, with her erratic behavior leading up to it, that she was definitely experiencing some sort of mental health break. And like I said earlier, hopefully if she had been receiving therapy, something like this could have been avoided, whether she was on medication or she had, you know, someone who was either looking out for her, something, some sort of intervention that could have prevented this. But since none of her friends or family seemed to even know what was going on, it leads me to believe that this is probably something that was scary and maybe even a little bit embarrassing to her, that this was something happening to her.
Her family was aware that she had mental health problems with the strange text messages she was sending to her mom. And I just wish the police did their job and looked after and protected her. Releasing her when she obviously wasn't doing well, they didn't do their job. And then they lied and they didn't protect someone who was vulnerable. Because as you said, it's obvious she did have mental health problems. Mm-hmm. And the family, as like I've just said, that they saw these developing not long before she disappeared. There was obviously something going on. Do I think that the police are directly involved in her death? Outside of being irresponsible and not doing their job, this just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, if they were involved, I think they would have done a better job in that she wouldn't have been seen trespassing within hours or within a few miles of the sheriff's office.
Right. I don't really buy into the whole theory of the sheriff's department being involved. I think they're complicit, though, because I think they really bungled the case. You know, they mishandled it at the beginning, and then they had to take steps to cover their own butts, and they just kept looking worse and worse and worse. And like you said, they failed in their job. And it just really, you know, she was extremely vulnerable. And I'm very disappointed in the police department and their failure to protect her.
The thing is, though, I don't see her making it to this other house where she was seen last. I can't see her making it there alone. Mm-hmm. I know it was only 6 miles, but it's something that I keep coming back to is the place where Matrice was found. It was known by law enforcement because of the pot farm, so it was known by drug dealers. So if she didn't get there on her own, who put her there? I mean, it is possible she did wander in there, but what if she did wander in there and then she stumbled across something she shouldn't have? Like maybe she saw, you know, some drug deal or the pot farmers or whatever were there doing something and they were scared they were going to get caught.
Sure. I feel like that's, I mean, killing a woman is extreme, but I guess I mean, that's not how I function. So I don't really, but I just feel like murder is a bigger deal than, you know, getting caught with pot.
Quick escalation. But yeah. I mean, we're not drug dealers, so I don't know. I don't know what's at stake. Are we talking, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars? Is there a lot riding on what they were doing? I don't know.
Right, and I think that's a good way to put it. Like, what is at stake for them to commit a murder like this? I think that, you know, and the way I think about it, I just don't see some pot plants being worth it. But,
I just think that this could go one of two ways, to be honest. One was that she was wandering around because of the mental break that she was possibly having. She got lost or she fell down and then succumbed to the elements. Maybe she had an accident and hurt herself and then she passed away. The second option is that she went wandering again, same scenario, because of this mental break that she seemed to be having, and then she possibly came across the wrong person. And I know people say, like in the Maura Murray case, what is the likelihood she came across a murderer or serial killer or rapist or whatever? But how long was Matrice out there for? Like, we don't know. She could have been walking around for days for all we know, because the search didn't really start for 3 days and they didn't go into the canyon. And due to the inaction of the law enforcement, we probably won't ever know what happened. It's just a really sad case, especially for the family who have tried so hard.
And I tend to believe that probably she stumbled upon someone or someone stumbled upon her, and that's mostly just because she was found naked. And like you were saying, it's highly unlikely that an animal or water stripped her. I think, you know, that to me shows human involvement and more so than just some sort of accident that happened. It just goes back to the police department, I think, again. It took them so long to find her that by the time they did, so much evidence that they might have been able to use had it happened several months earlier was just gone. And now we have all these questions that we'll probably never have the answers to.
It goes right back to the night she was arrested. She obviously wasn't doing well, yet they happily just released her onto the streets without any money, without any means to contact her family to be picked up. That was extremely irresponsible, because what happened to her, it just shouldn't have happened.
And I think that's the most frustrating part. It just should not have happened.
And then her mum was on the phone several times asking what was going on. Like, she was happy to come and get her, but they gave her the impression that they were holding her. It's just a really frustrating situation.
Yep.
And before we finish off, there were lawsuits taken out by Michael and Latrice on the sheriff's department. And in the end, the family was awarded $900,000 out of court. That doesn't get their daughter back. That doesn't answer the multitude of questions I'm sure the family do have. But I'm sure that it does bring them some peace. The awareness was given of what happened and that it wasn't right. That there was a huge violation of human safety here. And then finally, the body was exhumed at the insistence of the family, and it was also determined on the second examination of the body. It was pretty much the same conclusion as the first, that the cause of death could not be determined. And unless they do a search and find some more bones or some kind of evidence, I don't think that they can ever come to a definite conclusion. Okay, so some thank yous. Firstly, to our patrons on Patreon, thank you to Clem, Tiffany, Heather P, Megan G, and Lisa S. And then to our lovely 5-star reviews, and we do really appreciate them. We know that iTunes doesn't make it the easiest. But thank you to Mopage, T at Like It, Mandy G 33K, a whole bunch of J's, and Elissa from Miami. And where can people find you again, Zach?
You can find us. We're on iTunes. We're on pretty much any other app you might use to find podcasts. Again, our show is Mystery Yes. If you are having trouble spelling it, it's like the word mysterious, but you take out the O-U-S and replace it with Y-E-S, because we're just goofy, and that's what we decided to do. But you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Mysterious, and then our Facebook is Mysterious Podcast.
And we are also on Facebook. We have the page where we post all the episodes and discussion group, where it's a private group where we discuss the episodes, we talk about documentaries, other podcasts we listen to. There are pictures of cute baby animals to kind of change the subject of all the murders and horrible things in the world. And we also talk about any other case that we're interested in. We are on Twitter, where you can chat to Charlie, and that's at InsightfulPod. I post photos on Instagram, and that's at InsightPod. And we both answer the emails insightfulpod@gmail.com. We have a PayPal for a one-off donation and a Patreon for an ongoing monthly donation. On Patreon, we have some great rewards for our patrons, such as a monthly bonus episode, stickers, magnets, t-shirts, and Charlie will also send you a lovely handwritten thank you card.
I've gotten one. It is lovely.
She's got lovely handwriting.
She does. It's sitting right in front of me.
All links are on our website, insightpod.com. You can also listen to our episodes there and read our show notes. I'll add those links on we've talked about throughout the episode. And finally, it would mean the world to us if you would rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. It does give us a bump up the charts and brings more people to the podcast.